Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2013. Lecture 2, delivered on August 21, 2013. The title of this lecture is Finance, Financial Markets, and Interest Rates.
Today, Finance, Financial Markets, and Interest Rates. This begins with a couple of items that are specific to finance. And then it moves on from those items for finance majors, or if you were interested in finance, or if you were contemplating changing from a boring subject like marketing, accounting, management, insurance, or anything else to an exciting field like finance, this would give you a little information about what you're going to face as far as your choices go for your direction. Finance can be broken down into some sub-disciplines. And the sub-disciplines aren't just career-oriented. They're oriented also, at least to some extent, in terms of the thinking that's required, who you serve, and all of that. For example, one subdiscipline of finance, I should say, would be what most people think of as finance, investments. This is by no means the only area of finance you can go into, but investments is one of the areas you can go into. This is your traditional selling stock or buying stock or taking care of people's investments in one way or another, money, and making it grow, or at least hoping you can make it grow. Investments oftentimes involves getting licensed as a broker, which would entail getting something like the Series 7 license, which is a very difficult examination. Did any of you ever see the movie Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith? True story, that was. Cool story. It kind of surprised me. Hardly anyone knew of it outside of finance, and now it's become better. But when Will Smith was in that movie, posing as the guy who actually did this, all that studying he was doing under nightmare conditions of his personal and economic life, he was studying for the Series 7. It's a killer exam, really tough. But at the end of the day, once you've gotten through that licensing, then you can buy and sell stocks. Usually you work for a brokerage house in doing that. That's all I'm not going to go into it any deeper. You'll find out more about it if you choose to pursue a career in finance. Now, another aspect of finance that you could get into is institutional finance. In other words, you work for a bank or a savings and loan, or you work in that kind of environment where you serve in some capacity as part of financial intermediation that is done by institutions. Now, remember what I said. Financial intermediation doesn't necessarily involve financial institutions, but a great deal of it does. And the institutional finance, you would go take courses like money and banking. And you would get to handle money. You would, if a lot of people, interestingly enough, even with a degree, you might end up starting as a bank teller. You would rise quickly with a degree and showing your ambition, but it starts kind of at a low end, maybe even a lower salary, but then along the way you start accelerating up, getting more and more responsibilities, and ultimately you live a decent life. You make at least a living at it. Now, I want to point out something, and this is something that the chapter in the book where this is mentioned bear with me. It doesn't mention this one. It mentions another one, but I don't think this they ever revised it to mention one that's rather kind of important to us anymore. I'll mention that one last. The ones in the book are, the last of the one, three in the book is financial management. Now, this is internal, corporate internal. This is the kind of work where you are saying up and down to projects. You are analyzing, okay, how's this project going? Or someone comes to you from marketing. Do I have any marketing majors in here? Mother of God. Woman, you come to me and you say, I have the greatest marketing idea since sliced bread. Is that so? Yes. We got the project all laid out. We got the costs here. We got the revenues. We want to show you this. Now, tell us that we're going to, this is a go. And I look at it and I say, this is ass. No. Have you seen Grumpy Cat? You know Grumpy Cat? Okay, Grumpy Cat. I'm Grumpy Cat. I say no. And you say, but why? Because it sucks. That's my job. I don't say it sucks. You know, I'm professional. I say it sucks donkey head. Okay? Understand what I'm doing. I am the gateway as a financial management as a financial manager. I am the gateway. You can tell me the cost. You can give me projections. I'll check those out on my own, probably, because I won't believe you, because you are kind of dodgy looking to begin with. But I will check that part out. Look at your assumptions. Look at the cost structure. Consider costs that maybe you have missed. Like, remember those opportunity costs I talked to you about? I'll look at those. And then what I'll do is, traditionally, I'll look at what's called net present value. And I'll teach you how to do that in this class. That's one of the things I teach you, is how to look at what the value right now is of the future expected cash flows. We have to telescope the future cash flows back to the present and find out what all of that money that's going to come in is worth now versus all the money that I'm going to have to put into the project now. And if the present value of the money that's coming in now is better than the present the cost of the project that I'm going to spend now, then I'll say yes. But if it's not, I'm going to say no. The truth of the matter is that it's actually not that... Well, I shouldn't say this, but... I mean, if I see a project that has this wildly positive net present value, this thing is just incredible. I mean, the future expected cash flows are just staggering compared to the cash outlays for the project. Just an amazing project. There'd be one question that I would ask in my mind very quickly. Now, I don't expect you to be able to hit it on the head, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Try to be a cynical son of a bitch. In other words, try to be me. What would you say, son?
Probably nothing.
Yeah, sounds good to me. Yeah, let's go with it. It's wildly positive net present value. By the way, I sneak in a lot of words on you early on. That's the way to learn them, is to just start throwing them at you, and then you get more formalized later. When you learn language, when you were young, you learned language. You didn't say, what the hell is the definition of that word? No, you just heard it, and you figure, oh, I'll use it, and if I'm wrong, whatever. Okay, but can anyone think of a good question?
What's the catch?
Oh, that's sort of exact. That's along the way. Yeah, that's sort of in the right area. Here's what I would say. Why hasn't someone found this one before? In a vast universe of hundreds and hundreds of millions of businesses and marketing geniuses and financial analysts and greedy people all over the world, why hasn't anyone found this project yet? It's sort of like, have you ever gotten one of those emails from the Nigerians who want to tell you that there's money waiting for you? or something like that. Or that there is this great pot of gold and all you have to do is throw a few hundred dollars and you'll get all this money back. It's the same thing. Why would I see a project that was so phenomenally positive, NPV, net present value? And it just so happens that here I am, standing here, and the Lord has blessed me with the first time that it's ever been seen, this incredible project. Not likely to happen. So I would get, as you said, what's the catch? What am I not seeing? Or how was it that I got blessed with this incredible idea that no one ever had before? That does not mean it doesn't happen. And that does not mean that you don't go to the finance people with these ideas. But it's our job to try to find out what's the catch. What in the heck is going on here that I'm seeing a project of this incredible scope that has never been seen before? Now, it might be that you are just the marketing genius of the universe. It's just no one ever saw it before. And you saw it. But I don't think so. I mean, you know, I'm not criticizing you as a well, yeah, I am. Come on. You know, really? Maybe it is. But that's the thing that we have to do. We have to be that harsh voice at the end of the day. The accounting people can produce their financial statements, even projections of financial statements. The marketers, they have the ideas, and for heaven's sake, they have incredible ideas. And the management people get the job done once it's a go. And then they come back with, well, you projected costs, I worked on costs. They come back and say, these were the costs. But before anything gets started, we have to do that sanity check, that reality check. And that's part of what we do in financial management. In some ways, I'm going to tell you something right now. I ran a penny stock house. I lived in the world of brokering and all of that among the people. I've known the people. Some of them have been my students. Some of them my friends. It is a rough life. Most of the time, if you get into the world, you're going to end up in a boiler room. And it's going to be churn and burn. And most of the people who do that don't last more than a few months, a few years before they're snorting so much coke that their nose pops out through their butt. It's an exciting, dynamic, powerful world that it just, for some people, it's just you can't leave it. But at the same time, it's also a harsh, demanding, cutthroat world. When I was in the business at the height of my heyday, thinking that I could take over the universe and I had special connections to God with my strength and my intelligence, which turned out to be a lie, I saw what it was like there on the floor. Back in those days, the traders, before the bell, you would hear in the bathrooms several interesting things. All these traders milling around, swirling back in that time. And you knew very well that some of them were blowing coke. And then there were some who were cutting it with heroin because the heroin was a sedative and it would keep them from popping up and down out of their shorts. Go out there on the floor, it was just constantly just pouring at you in all directions. And you were getting orders in and you were trying to figure out, how am I going to fill this order? Part of it I'll work out over here, part of it I'll work out over there. I just ran into a guy, he can fill some of my order. Things like that, just at you. And it's just ridiculous. But some people just thrive in that world and they just want it. Or you can, in investments, you can work in a small house or a big house. I took my students in finance up to the finance club up to Chicago. I think it was 2 years ago, was it? We went to a big brokerage house, really cool. You know, a lot of traders working, brokers working, doing their business with the traders on the floor of the exchanges, working with their clients on investments. And that was fairly, the guys were sitting there, they were keeping their eyes on all these screens and working out deals and schmoozing with people who could get deals done for them, schmoozing with their customers. And then, but it's still very high pressure. You've got to watch yourself. If you make a mistake, the compliance people will burn your ass. And then you'll probably also get in trouble with the government and the self-policing organizations. Then I took him over to a boutique house. Now, a boutique house is a small, highly selective clientele place. In other words, a place where there are very rich people investing and very rich people owning the house. And this one that we went to, we go in there, and it was run by an old Greek guy and his son. The Greek guy just got lucky in the stock market, which is the way most of these supposed geniuses do it. It's not genius, it's luck. But he made just insanely big money, and he put his son in charge with him. So we go in there, into this house, and the first thing that this son says, well, yeah, this is a five-story building, and it's cut out of a single block of marble that we brought from Greece. Huh? Yeah, well, for the consistency of the pattern of the marble. And as we went from floor to floor, it was quiet and peaceful. And the trader, the brokers sitting there, they said, well, we don't really do anything. We let the financial engineers do the investing work for us as far as what investments to go. And this guy, who was one of the owners, he's just walking around looking at the employees, keeping his eye on everyone, then showed us his beautiful art. Such a beautiful place. And I said, how many of you want to work here? And a lot of the students, oh, yeah, I'd love to work there. And I said, that's good, because you see those two guys? They're not geniuses, but you're going to be their bitch for the rest of your life if you work at a place like this. Okay, so just reel it forward. Just last spring, we went up to Chicago to J.P. Morgan. It's a wonderful place, but they sat my students down. I said, well, the first thing you have to understand is that we deal with people who have substantial money. If your family or you has less than $30 million, we're really not interested in handling your money. And then the son of a bitch looked right at me like, bite me. Yeah, things like that. So you can work in a world of very wealthy people, for wealthy people, on behalf of wealthy people and wealthy families. And that's part of this world. Or you can work in the trenches in a boiler room just trying to talk suckers into buying stock that rich people are dumping off, and you got to find a place to unload it. Now there's one other one that the book really doesn't mention. Financial planning. I know some people in finance, I don't want to get into that at all. One of the problems with financial planning is that a lot of the field is dominated by these large companies that essentially churn you in and then burn you out very quickly. And I'll talk more about this nasty little scam that's going on. Even here at ISU, we have those guys showing up offering jobs, and it's really not cool. You don't want to get into that. But there are places where you can be a financial planner and actually have a good living and do good for people. Some of the big insurance companies are very ethical, and they hire you and they work with you. And over a period of time, you slowly move from salary over to commission, and others are just gaming you. Now, I've known them on both sides of it. Financial planning, you're helping people figure out what they're going to do. I'm looking here. Right now, okay, what are you going to be doing when you're 60 years old? I have not a clue. That's okay. Live life. YOLO, you know? Said many people right before death. Okay. The thing is that what we do in financial planning is we help people make their goals achievable. We say, okay, look, you just got married. Okay? Her name is Ethel, and she has 5 kids from previous marriages, and you've just decided you've bought your first house trailer, you know, beautiful one, double wide trailer for a double wide woman, and you're on your way. You got assistant managership at a McDonald's. On the weekends, you do Elvis impersonations at children's parties. Okay? Life is good. But you've got to make plans. Someday you don't want to live in a trailer. You want to move up to a little house. And then from there, you're going to have to pay for all those kids' education years after that. And then you're going to have to plan for your retirement and all those medical bills that are going to come along the way. Probably about the age of 40, you'll have your first heart attack. And then at 50, your prostate's going to get really big and it's going to scare the hell out of people when you walk down the street. And then maybe about 60, dementia will begin to set in and you'll be standing out on your porch saying, "My house has stately bay windows," and things like that. And so you've got to plan for all this. That's what we do, financial planning. We say, all right, here's your goals. You tell me what you want to achieve. We're going to tell you what you have to put away every month or every paycheck or every quarter for you to accomplish those goals. Because that money's going to earn interest. And the more risk that you're willing to bear, the faster you'll achieve goals. So we've got to figure out what your risk level is. That's the kind of stuff you do in financial planning. And we're actually going to do some financial planning, basic financial planning exercises in this class. So you'll be able to see it. And it's not cut and dried. Like, for example, I was talking to a very good financial planner. He's been in the business for years. He deals with people, upper income people, with net assets, net worth above $5 million. And he said, sometimes, you know, I had it all laid out. We had about a 95% probability that this couple, was going to achieve their goals for their retirement. Retire at 50 years old and be able to travel the world and all that. Well, when I went there to talk to them for our quarterly meeting, it turned out they bought themselves a yacht. He said, well, what that does is that drops the probability of them achieving their goals to 65%. And he had to tell them that. You made a move that is reducing your probability of achieving your long-term goals. You made a short-term move. So you have to kind of be that harsh voice. And sometimes when someone comes to you, well, I'm thinking of doing this, you might have to say, if you do that, these will be the very dark consequences of that. Okay, so that's financial planning. Some people really get into it. I've got a former student of mine who just let me know that he did his internship in financial planning. He was a finance major, but he hadn't taken much coursework in financial planning. But he got his internship at the end of his junior year in financial planning. I just saw him this morning. I said, well, how did you like it? And he said, I love it. And I want to do this. I want to do this. And he's actually got kind of the demeanor. He's not really forceful. He's not a hard sell kind of guy. So he might actually be very successful in this. He's more willing to let people talk to him. He listens. And then he thinks. So it doesn't necessarily require that you take tons of courses in financial planning. You have to know finance really well. But if you find out that it's the kind of thing you like, well, great. I got a female student. She actually has her specialization in financial planning. She was afraid some company was going to find out that she had a specialization in financial planning in her finance degree because she hates doing it. Enough of that. Let me get you on to another subject. Take you on another direction here. And this was covered in your Business 100 course. You've probably seen it in other courses. But what hits me is that when I give the first exam and the essay, their short essay questions, there seems to be this kind of fundamental disconnect, and I work hard to get this disconnect from happening in terms of what it means to, well, let me ask this question. Of all of these fine people in here, this is kind of, I mean, this is obviously going to be an easy question. Sir, what is business?
I don't know.
You're majoring in business. You're in the College of Business, damn it. But don't get me wrong. That's the usual thing that I get, is that You know, think about it this way. You're walking down in a bad part of this city. Okay? You're on Market Street. Rough place. You accidentally turn down an alley and you hear footsteps behind you getting closer. And there's lots of these footsteps. You walk faster and they get still getting closer. You say, oh my God, it's a dead-end alley. And you get to the end of the alley. Bravely, you turn around. It's your worst nightmare. Yeah, it's the Market Street business gang. And they ask you one question. Are you down on business? And if you are, what is business? Okay. You die right there on the spot. Uh-huh. Yeah. So now let's talk about what business is. Business is the organization of a group or an individual for the purpose of bringing together factors of production to create output. Group or individual that will bring together factors of production for the purpose of creating output. Now it can be a group, but there's a reason why you're doing it. Why would you engage in business? That one's for you. Madam, why would you engage in business? Yeah, okay. That's what we call duh. We're doing it not because we care about people. We say that. But we're doing it because we want to make money. But remember that relationship between risk and return. In order to achieve a return, some expectation. In order to have an expectation, we're going to have to bear risk. So in other words, business in the capitalist framework means that we have to find someone who is willing to take the risk of combining factors of production to create output. Unique to our market economy, then, is a special factor of production. It is equity. That willingness to bear risk to achieve an expected return. You wouldn't find that in a communist system. The government bears all the risk. When you hear this bull crap, oh, all right, we're turning into a socialist economy here. No, we're not. We bear risk. I'm putting risk on the line every day with my corporation. Many of you will be business. You'll try to start your own business if you haven't already. You know, I can see, you know, the meth lab you've been talking about. Yeah. The male prostitution ring. Or not. You see, we do it all the time in our economy. We bear risk. That's what makes us the capitalist economy. We're going to bring our equity to bear, either through the sweat of our own brow or other people's money, which is great when you can find it, seriously. We are going to command capital and bring the factors of production together with some technology on them so that they can make an output. And the reason we do it is because there is money to be made and we're willing to put our butts on the line, risk everything to have that happen. Business can be broken down into three very broad categories. The first is the simplest form of business, and many of you, perhaps almost all of you, have actually had this organizational form of a business. It's called a sole proprietorship. A sole proprietorship. a one-person show, you bear all of the risk, and you are the one who gets anything that comes in after the cost. That means that in this position, you run a lawn mowing service. You change your name to David so you can have Dave's lawn mowing service. You see, we can use fictitious names. Actually, I have several fictitious names that I work under. In Illinois, they're called assumed names. And you do these at the county level, but it's a state thing. So I apply for a fictitious name under which I can run my business. It's called a DBA, a doing business as. And then I can give it a name if I want. So, for example, I have a long-standing name called Dark Wraith Publishing. And then I have a corporation, but I have a fictitious name that the state recognizes as mine for another called Emergent Light Studio. And I have a few more too. But this is essentially just an assumed name that I use for doing a business, and in this case, as an individual. So instead of saying, make your check out to Alan, you make your check out to Dark Wraith Publishing, for example. Not that there's any revenue comes in there anymore, but it's still there and it's protected. You fill out this form with the county. The county, and then what they give you a recognition that you've started the process. Then you have a business publication for 3 weeks, I think it's still 3 weeks, announce this person is attempting to command this name for his business. If you have a dispute, you have to make it in this period. So at the end of the 3 weeks, if no one has contacted that business publication disputing my claim to the name, then I get a notice from the business publication, no challenge, and then I take that back to the county recorder, and they actually, the clerk of the county recorder, and they say right there on the spot, it's yours forever. So that's how you get this assumed name. So you could have your checks made out to Dave, or you could have them to Dave's mowing service if you wanted to do it like a DBA. But you run this mowing service. So you bought some equipment, you borrowed on your credit card to get your lawn mowing equipment. So that means you're personally responsible for it. You got to pay the bill or they'll come and take your house. Now, also, you get to keep all the money that comes in. Pay your bills with it if you want to, or you can screw your bills and they'll come and take everything away from you. You're mowing a rich person's lawn one day, and all of a sudden you hear something that you really don't want to hear. You know what you hear? Hey, 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 hey! Yes, you ran over their damn poodle. You have to pay for that dog. Okay? You see, there's the problem, is that you, not a company, you have to pay for that dog. And if you don't have enough money with your lawnmower when they liquidate it, and your trimming shears, and that new Black & Decker power weed eater, they'll just come and take your house. They'll take everything. Because there is no corporate veil to protect you individually from what happens. Okay? So that's a sole proprietorship. You are all at risk. And I've done those before. If you're doing something that's, you know, there's really nothing that can happen to you. Yeah, sole proprietorships are great. And almost all of you have been sole proprietors. If you mowed a lawn and got money for it. You did babysitting and you got money for that. All of this was sole proprietor work. Almost every one of you, at some time or another, has been an entrepreneur. Welcome to capitalism, you running capitalist dogs. Now partnership is essentially the same thing as sole proprietorship, except that there is more than one person. So the liability is joint and several. But you're still all at risk. I mean, if something one partner screws up, you all screw up. And you're all liable. Now, there's a form of that called a limited partnership where you can get money from these people and they're not allowed to do any management at all. They have to sit off to the side, but in exchange, their liability is limited. There's one thing about sole proprietorships and partnerships, and I've brought this up before, but I'm going to have to do it again. Woman, you are going to die. I know that. It's going to happen. I don't know when, but you're going to be dead. You're going to be worm food rotting in the ground and all that. In a sole proprietorship or a partnership, death is final. That's the end of the company. If you die, your sole proprietorship dies with you. If you and I were in a partnership together and I die, the partnership is over. Did you know that? Partnerships don't survive death. You can make arrangements so that there's some kind of a reconstitution of the essentially the same animal. But the basic idea is that these are mortal. They have the same characteristics as human beings do in the sense that they die with the death of one of what we call the principals. And that's with P-A-L. If a principal dies in a sole proprietorship or a general partner or a partnership, a general partnership specifically, that's the end of it. Game over. Okay? Now, there are some variations on these animals, like there are these limited partnerships that I meant, professional associations of different kinds that are sort of like partnerships, and then there's this faddish thing called an LLC, which you really should avoid, especially because it's such a fad and people don't really grasp the consequences of LLC. So I don't get into limited liability companies in this class. We take you to the final form of a business organization. The pinnacle of capitalism. It is called a corporation. A corporation is quite special. And I have actually formed and been the head of corporations. Only a few of them didn't die very quickly of their own stupidity. But professional landscape photography business is a corporation. Specifically, it's a kind called a subchapter S, or now they call them S-corps. But it's a corporation. Now, here's how it works. And I've done these as a consultant for other people. We would get together. Okay, we want to create a corporation. So we're going to have a meeting of the organizers. And at this meeting of the organizers, we will prepare a document called the Articles of Incorporation. The Articles of Incorporation. Now, these Articles of Incorporation are quite formal. It used to be kind of fun to put them together. Now you can do it online. They've got automated services. The state of Illinois makes it just no fun at all because all you have to do is push a few buttons and there you are. You've got a corporation. But essentially, the Articles of Incorporation, they say what the name of the company is. Now, if it's a corporation, it has to end in the United States with a comma. And then Inc., I-N-C, Incorporated, Co., C-O, period, or Company, or I apparently now, and this was a little surprise to me when I formed Emergent Light Studio, you can actually use LTD, Limited, as one of the endings. Now, in other countries, the comma would not be there, but in the United States, typically, you would see, for example, with my company, Emergent Light Studio, comma, Inc. But you'll see in other countries, like Canada, I notice that they don't have. Now, the equivalents in other countries might not be company, or in England, you might see limited. In Germany, you would see something that starts with a G. But they are the flag that this is a corporation. Now, the corporation, the Articles of Incorporation, what's your name? What's the business address? Principal business address. There will be a few more things. Among them, you will have to name someone who will be the agent for the service of process. In other words, if there's any kind of court proceeding or any business the government has with you, you have told them who is to get the mail. It doesn't necessarily, as a matter of fact, there are services that do this. You can hire a lawyer who will be an agent for service of process, whatever. You will also see a declaration of how the capital stock of the corporation is to be divided. So in a case like a simple corporation like mine, I declared that there would be 1 million shares authorized. In other words, I could theoretically divide the ownership of the corporation into 1 million equal units. Now that's how many I can. That's authorized. Outstanding is how many I issue. So to start the ball rolling, I issued myself 500 shares. And I figured that'll get things going. Now you always want to leave a big, huge pad because you can sell those shares to raise capital. That's called equity. And usually you do it with common stock. That division is common stock, usually. There are other ways we'll talk about later. Okay, so in other words, with 500 shares, I could sell a whole lot of shares. I wouldn't want to do that, probably, because then some other interests would have majority control. As it stands now, I control the corporation even if I sell 499 more shares. I'm still the majority shareholder for voting. That's the Articles of Incorporation. You send those to the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation. Corporations are not federal. They are state entities. Feds don't have anything to do with it. It's a state thing. Now, if I file Articles of Incorporation in a state, like suppose I incorporate in Delaware, I am a domestic corporation in Delaware, but in every other state, I'm a foreign corporation. So I can actually have my offices in Illinois, all of my business in Illinois, but incorporate in Delaware. I'm domiciled in Delaware, I'm foreign in Illinois, and my principal business offices are in Illinois. The reason you might want to do that is because some states are much more favorable to businesses than other states. Delaware has an ancient, highly developed corporation law. Its judges are just masters of understanding the nuances of business and all that. So it's a good state for that favorability. In the case of my company, I decided to do it easy and just incorporate in Illinois because my business is here. There are some states that are downright hostile. You would not want to incorporate there. They specifically make it a friggin' nightmare. And even if it's not that hard to incorporate there, their rules regarding how corporations operate and all that, their franchise tax and all that, are murder. So you would want to avoid states like that. I won't mention any states, but Florida is one. There are other states that used to be very, very favorable. They were just like Wild West that turned ugly because they had so much craziness go on. Utah is one of them. Utah, I still wouldn't go back there because of possible wants and warrants on me. No, literally, it was bad. I got out of a major problem there because this financial examiner for the state, I convinced him that I was interested in converting to Mormonism. I shit you not. That was how I got kept from getting indicted. Assholes. But anyway, look. The Secretary of State does not approve a corporation. The government in no circumstance whatsoever approves of anything you do. You send it documents, Securities and Exchange Commission filings with the state to Articles of Incorporation. No matter what you do, there is never an approval. At best, what you get is qualification. In other words, if my Articles of Incorporation are in order, everything is right, I receive notice back from the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation that my Articles of Incorporation have been qualified. That's the closest you ever get to approval. That means I have created a legal entity separate from myself. The state now recognizes that that corporation is not me. It is its own animal, its own responsibilities to pay its bills, its own responsibilities for its taxes, for its financial statements, for everything. It is separate from its owners. To reinforce that, your next move, once you got the information, the qualification back from the Secretary of State of the state of incorporation, you fill out form SS9 with the feds. That's the IRS form that gets you your Federal Employer Identification Number, the FEIN. In other words, just like when you give birth to a baby, you get a birth certificate from the state and you get a Social Security number from the federal government. It's just like that for a corporation. You get a birth certificate from the state, you're a qualified articles of incorporation, and you get a Social Security number from the federal government. That's your Federal Employer Identification Number. It's its own animal. It really is its own person. It is not you. It is not a human, but in law, it is called a person. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court of the United States over a period of years, and dramatically a couple of years ago, took that so far that they said, well, corporations are persons, so they have free speech rights just like anyone else in the Constitution. That was phenomenally amazing that we now recognize that corporations aren't just persons, separate legal entities under the law, but they're constitutionally protected under the First Damn Amendment, which is kind of creepy when you think about it. When they get to the Second Amendment and corporations can carry guns, makes you wonder, can you marry a corporation? I don't know. But here you go, corporations. So when you see an accounting, assets equals liabilities plus owner's equity, that is literally showing you the legal structure of the body of a corporation. There is a corporate veil between the company and its bills and the owners. The company can incur debts, and only the company is responsible for paying those debts. The owners, the most they can lose is their investment. The debt holders cannot come through the corporate veil to get to you, unless they can prove that you were just using the corporation as a sham, and that's quite hard to do. Those debt holders are stuck at the door of the corporation. That does not mean, well, you know, we'll just rack up bills in this corporation. Don't do it. Because at the end of the day, the bondholders answer the question, who's your daddy? Because if you don't pay your shareholders a dividend, your stock doesn't go up, you know what happens? Nothing. They bitch and they whine, they cry. But what are they going to do? They are the owners. They can't do anything. But you know what happens if you don't pay your bondholders? It's bad. They'll shoot your dog. They'll sell your Bible on Craigslist. And they will make your mother wear furry costumes that please them. Mr. Fox's starter kit's really good. But it's that bad. The bondholders, you answer to them. Debt rules. Essentially, all they have to do is sit back and essentially, if, you know, the shareholders, you can screw them over year after year. They'll bitch and they'll whine, but as long as I'm majority shareholder or I've got a coalition that's a majority, the worst they could do is probably go to some lawyers and try to do some kind of shareholder derivative action. But practically speaking, for the most part, as a consultant, We would talk about these shareholder meetings. The officers were scared to death. These shareholders are going to chew us alive. Let them chew us alive. What are they going to do to us? Are they going to pee on us? What are they going to do? Burn down the corporation? Well, there's a good idea. They're the owners of it along with us. So yeah, they're going to do that. So unfortunately, they usually had me go out there and tell them that. But that's just the reality of it. Now, again, in other words, liabilities are like bonds, notes, common stock. I'm sorry, whoa. Bonds, notes, bills. That's liabilities. You pay your bills. You borrow on short with bills. You borrow intermediate with notes. You borrow long with bonds. Owners, the most typical representation of ownership is common stock. Now, there are other animals like preferred stock, and sometimes common stock has class A and class B. But for the most part, common stock is the representation of ownership. Okay? Understand that. Now let's talk about how you... Someone pointed out quite astutely that we like to make money in business. Now there are actually a couple of different ways that you can get money for a company. Here's one of the worst things in the world is that you probably are going to need money to make money. And that's one of the things that I've seen as a frustration oftentimes with entrepreneurs is that... Well, how am I supposed to make money if I don't have the money to start making the money? And that's why I'm never impressed when rich people start a business or the kids of some rich person from another era. Well, these kids are rich, you know, they've started these wonderful businesses. They're bullshit. They had the money to do it, to start it, and to nurture it. For the real world of us, starting a business means you're going to have to slog it out, probably use a lot of your own money and the opportunity cost of your own time, what we call sweat equity, before you're even going to have some kind of possible angel come in or a bank to lend you a little bit more to get you really started. And that's one of the difficult things. You see, because you're going to have to raise money in some way. Even huge corporations have to raise money sometimes. And they do it routinely. Short-term money, short-term funds are in what we call the money market. If you are looking for money or you are willing to provide money for less than a year, you are in the money market. Now, the money market, interestingly, even huge corporations use money markets. There's an instrument called commercial paper that big, huge corporations use all the time. It's 30 days, borrow from rich people, institutions, they lend for 30 days, and then it's all over. Big corporations do this for cash management purposes, for quick money for projects of completion or something like that. It's a very thick market, and there are a lot of investors who want to invest for just a short period of time and get their money back. And a lot of corporations that want to borrow for a short period of time and get their money back. Commercial paper is issued by large creditworthy corporations, and the surplus economic units that provide the money are usually very wealthy individuals or institutions. Oh, cash flush institutions. Money market. Now, another market that is big out there is the one for money that's long-term. When you want to borrow money for more than a year, or you want to get money for more than a year, that would be the capital market. That would be the capital market. Now, if you want to raise money for your corporation by selling common stock, that would come from the capital market because common stock lasts forever. Once that person is an owner, you're stuck. It's worse than marriage. Because at least with marriage, you can divorce or at least kill yourself. But with common stock, you're married to that. So you can raise money. I've literally actually had a couple of angel investors in the area here who've seen my work and said they wanted to invest as owners. Buy 100 shares for $10,000. Yeah, that's not bad for a company as piss-ass as small as mine. But if I did that, they'd be with me forever. They might be able to sell it, although it's difficult when you've got an S-corp to do that kind of trick. But, I mean, that's kind of scary to think about something like that. If you borrow money, you pay it back and the bondholders are gone. So if I borrow money for more than a year, that is in the capital market as well. Let me break down debt. Less than 1 year or equal to 1 year, that kind of debt is called a bill. And you, if you are the borrower for less than a year, you are actually the issuer of the bill. And the lender is the buyer, the owner of the bill. So it sounds kind of weird, and that's one of those places I was talking about, the turning points in your thinking, is that when you borrow money, you are literally the issuer of the debt. And who buys it, that is the purchaser of the debt, and the amount of the loan is the price that you charged to sell the debt. I'll say that a few more times over the next lecture or two to get that to soak in. But anyway, so you say, oh, I got a bill in the mail. Well, no, you actually didn't. You issued the bill, and now you're getting a notice from whoever lent you the money that it's due. Well, how does that work? I got an electricity bill. Well, you see, the electric company fronted you the cost of that electricity. You issued that company a bill. You sold the electric company a bill. The price of it was the amount that they didn't make you pay instantly. Now they're sending you a notice. Your bill is due. Your bill is due. Between 1 and 7 years, that is called a note. If you borrow money for between 1 and 7 years, that's a note. So when you borrow for a car, that's usually you are selling a note to a bank. The bank is buying that note from you, and the price it's paying is the car loan price. Sounds weird, but that's how it works. And then the big kahunas. More than 7 years, that's what's called a bond. Well, so that first house you're going to buy, you are going to go to a bank and you're going to sell that bank a bond. You say, well, I go to the bank and the bank's got all the paperwork. I'm not writing a bond instrument. Yes, you are. They're just giving you the convenience of making sure it's written properly. You are actually the issuer, the writer, the seller of the bond. And the bank that lends you the money is the purchaser, the buyer. And the price that they are paying is what you need to borrow. That's how it works. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.